Welcome to the Success Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts.
Welcome back to the Success Leaves Clues podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Are you a small business owner who thinks they pay too much in taxes? We can help. Give us a call or book a meeting by clicking the link in the show notes to book a free financial consultation so you can have peace of mind about your financial future. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. I'm your host, Robin Bailey, here on my favorite day of the week, Podcast Friday. And today, Al is absent. I'm not absent from work, but absent from the podcast for a very special reason, because I have a very special co-host today, a good friend of mine, Deb Voorhees. Deb, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here as a co-host. We had so much fun when I was a guest that can't wait to be here today.
Well, I was about to say, people will likely remember you from being a guest. And we did. We had so much fun. We've been out to lunch since. I think we're connected for life now, or at least our business lives, but hopefully longer. So I really do appreciate you joining me. And thank you for the introduction to our guest today. Joining us is Lisa Taylor, who is the president of Challenge Factory. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
My pleasure. It's nice to see you both.
Nice to see you. And right off the bat, I got to say, love the name Challenge Factory. I'm very curious. Can you tell me a bit more about the name of the company and where the name came from?
Yeah, sure. So it's a great question. So the short and quippy answer is it was a URL that was available when it was time to start the company. So I should mention that did factor into it a little bit. But the real answer is when I went to start Challenge Factory was founded on the premise that there were hard challenges that workforces were facing and leaders were going to be facing as demographic change and all kinds of things were going to start to happen to impact workforces and workplaces. People tended to throw their hands up and say, nobody knows how to solve these problems. And what I wanted to convey was a combination of where we can tackle really hard challenges. And there actually are ways, methodologies, procedures, processes that can help make sense of a changing world. And so that's where the factory component came in, where there are ways that we can move things through how we have learned how to do things, not so that everything comes out exactly the same, but so that we're learning from the processes that we have used in the past in order to address the challenges of the future. So those two words came together as the combination. And Challenge Factory was born.
I love that. And as you were chatting about that and saying about the fact, I pictured that in my mind, all these components, the end result coming out. But it's funny what you said about the URL that's available. And I know I'm not the only one that does this, but when I have an idea, I immediately go search it and then I'll buy it. So I must own at least 20 URLs right now. And I actually got an email the other day that someone wanted to buy one of the existing ones. So I haven't done anything about that yet, but we'll see where that goes. You know, it's funny, when I started this podcast, and it's had a couple of iterations, and the most recent is Success Leaves Clues, and we're chatting with successful people, and hopefully through this episode, teasing out one or two clues that can help other people. And it originally started in an avatar that you would fit into. You were the owner of the company, running a company. And then one day I'd met a lady named Joanna Kimyich, who is a chief people officer. Wonderful, wonderful person who's since become a very good friend of ours. And I came home to my wife and said, oh, I've got a new series, anything to do with HR related. I've got to come up with a name for that too. And my wife, being very good and listening to me talk all the time, kind of said, talk me through it. And she said, okay, well, what are you trying to do with Joanna? I said, well, I want to tease out the clues of why she's successful and how she's had success in her role in HR at her company that's been able to get them through a very tough time, COVID. This was at the time we were going through because nobody had a playbook for it. And my wife says, okay, that's, you're trying to tease out, you know, the ideas and things that she does successfully to bring that to her work. She said, the series that you have already, what are you trying to do with those people? Well, I'm trying to tease out the clues so that we can leave clues for other people. She kind of looks at me like, you don't need a new series, dummy. It's the same series. You just have a different avatar now. So I'm so glad that you're coming on, because we've just all lived through a very tumultuous time. I was in someone's office yesterday and they were trying to determine still what's the right answer in terms of return to work and that sort of thing. So I'm very glad you're here today to talk to us about a number of things. And I have a ton of questions, but I know Deb does as well. So I'm going to let Deb take the next one and I'll take a back seat for a few moments.
Thanks, Robin. Well, Lisa's work in the future of work really ties in with what we do at Big Wind Group, which is executive search and the leadership piece. I mean, we know that leaders start early, so that's why I've loved the Success Leaves Clues. And Lisa, your background is so diverse, and you've even starting off in the hospitality sector, Sheraton Hotel, and then moving through consulting to what you're doing now. How did you end up here?
Yeah, so I'm deep in the field right now of career development. That's one of the core competencies that Challenge Factory has that is unique within North America. And so I understand how careers unfold and all of the different ways that careers can take their trajectory in the work that we do with our clients and inside of organizations. But for me personally, the career theory that best captures how you would categorize how I've gotten here is really career happenstance. So that's a formal theory of career development. And basically it means a series of accidents have led you to where you are now. And it connects well to the theme of this podcast, the clues that get left, because what you need to pick up then is what are all the clues about how maybe those random events weren't actually so random. And so I graduated into wanting to do public sector consulting, got a job in a great consulting firm, Deloitte, was thrilled to be working there, found out on my first day that they had transferred me from the public sector consulting to technology consulting. This was in the 90s. I didn't know anything about technology. So decided I wasn't going to go back to the path I thought I was supposed to be on. I stuck it out. I ended up with a 12-year technology career that had me doing all kinds of work, strategic work, people work, change work, workforce dynamics, looking at all the different aspects of the non-technical elements of what happens when the internet transforms everything in business, right at the very beginning of the internet. That led me to phenomenal companies like Hewlett-Packard, where I ran their consulting business for Canada, their technical consulting group for Canada, and I did some global strategy work for them before I decided that I wanted to go out on my own and start my own firm that was focused in areas related to the future of work. And that's when I launched Challenge Factory. So I didn't mean to have a technology career. I didn't mean to end up doing global strategy for one of the largest technology companies in the world. I didn't mean to become an entrepreneur in my 30s. I thought that I would do that later in my career. But all the way along, these steps kind of led me to where I am now. And I couldn't be the president of Challenge Factory as it is now if I hadn't had those early career experiences of what happens when, you know, you're meeting with executives and trying to convince them that the internet is going to be a thing.
Right.
And then you go all the way through the whole shift and transformation of that revolution. I couldn't lead a company on the leading edge of workforce and talent revolution if I hadn't had those early career experiences. And I wouldn't have had them if I had been a public sector consultant. So I'm so grateful for all those happenstance moments that have happened along the way.
Well, it sounds like the thread is really that change management and being willing to take risks in your career. So it's really worked out well.
I think that's true. And I wouldn't have necessarily ever said that I'm, you know, particularly risk tolerant or I go seeking it. And yet when I look back, yeah, I'm pretty risk tolerant and I'm pretty good with dealing with change as it comes on the fly. Like these are all things I've learned about myself that I wouldn't have necessarily said, you know, the younger me wouldn't have necessarily put that into my profile.
I think that's something very common among entrepreneurs that we chat with. I mean, you have to be able to face that brick wall and figure out either I'm going through this, I'm going over it, or I'm going around it. And that's a common theme. And it's okay. For people that I meet, it's okay if that wall is going to stop you and that's not the environment you're going to thrive in. That's fine. You don't have to be. Not everyone has to be an entrepreneur. I do want to talk about something because I'm very curious about this myself. When we talk about the future of work I'm in this business, we talk about happenstance, but I am in this business because my dad came to Canada, found his way into insurance, worked for a very long time, had three kids. I was dad's last chance at carrying on this legacy because I was the one that took over the practice. But at the time, dad grew up in a time where you worked for one company for your entire career, you got your pension, you retired, you moved on. That is not what we're looking at today, or certainly it has been in the last, let's call it 10 to 15 years. It has changed dramatically. Going forward from here, Lisa, what do you see as the future of work? So if there's young people who are listening to this saying, okay, how are my next 30 years going to look? Or even how are my next 10 to 15 years going to look? What do you think that looks like today?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first fundamental thing that's really important for people to think about when they are trying to answer that question is just to have good basic understanding of how demographics have changed. So the traditional way of thinking about your career is really in three life stages. You go through a life stage where you learn everything you're going to need to know for the rest of your life. Then you go through a period of time where you earn all the money that you're going to need to make for the rest of your life. And then you go through a period of time where you burn all the money that you've just finished earning based on what you learned early on in your career. And that's kind of the way that our careers have always been shaped in the traditional model. And that doesn't work anymore. First of all, we can't possibly learn everything we need to know by the time we're 22. So we're going to have to continue to learn all the way through our careers, and not just in like little bits of training, but actually significantly adjusting to shifts and changes, including making significant career changes along the way as the norm. So we're going to learn all the way through. We're going to spread out how we earn our money. We're going to work longer. And I'm going to come back to that in just a second. And we're not going to retire the way that we used to. And I'm going to combine those two, the earning and the burning, in a different way. When the retirement age was set at 65, it was the 1930s. And life expectancy in the year that it was set at 65 was 62. So our idea of having a retirement at age 65 with an 83-year life expectancy means that we have a life expectancy that is in 2024, but a working life expectancy that's frozen as if it's still the 1930s. And because of that, we end up with so much dysfunction in how we think about our career. And what happens is those younger career folk that you were just talking about that are listening to this and wondering what their next 10 years are, they already feel like they're running out of time. We talk to people that are 25, 28, 32, 47, 63, 74. And the common theme across all of them is, I wish I had made a different choice. I've run out of time. I took this course. I'm on this path. I can't possibly change now. Nobody's running out of time. We've got lots of time. We've also got lots of ageism, but we've got lots of time. And I think that that's really important to think about. You know, you don't need to map out your next 30 years, but you do need to think about, how am I going to continue to learn, earn, and enjoy life for an 83-year life expectancy, not a 65-year life expectancy? How am I going to do that over the entire course of my life, as opposed to the shortened view that we normally have? That's the first piece I would say to them.
There's so much gold in that answer. And I wish we're not Tim Ferriss here, so we don't have 3-hour podcasts, but I'm sure even on that answer alone that we could. But Deb, I'm going to actually pass it over to you because I'm curious, because you're at a different stage of your career as well. And we talked about, because I know how I feel about the learning piece. You do go to school for a long time, and by 22, you think you know everything, but you don't. Okay. Sorry, kids. That's the reality. Because I'm even finding at my stage of the career, you know, we're adding a lot of newer, younger people. And I'm humbled almost every week by something that I didn't know that they said, oh, well, just do it like this. And Deb, I'd be curious to hear from your perspective, right? Because you and I are different stages as well.
Right.
What's your experience been from the learning perspective and how you're approaching that?
Well, I think I'm a great example of Lisa's theory of lifelong learning and that you don't run out of time. I had a retail career with my early career, then stay-at-home mom with lots of volunteer fundraising in the middle sector. And then I went back to school. I did an MBA and now I'm in executive search. And I'm not done. I mean, the thread for me has always been the relationships and that was one of those aha moments. What we're seeing in search, and Lisa, please, you know, confirm this or contradict, we are seeing that there is ageism, and Lisa and I have actually talked about that. And often it is not even technology-based. It's that they feel that older workers don't have the energy that younger workers will have. What older workers bring are soft skills, huge soft skills, huge wisdom. They've done it. They've experienced whatever situation has come up at least once or twice. So it's not the crisis that it might be for a younger person, where technology in particular tends to be very youth-focused. Finance, less so. They're open to some gray hair there because you just don't get the ability to do public offerings and quarterly reporting and dealing with boards right out of MBA school. So Lisa, does that resonate with what you're seeing?
It does. And what I would want to do is just myth bust a little bit that initial comment that you were making about where one of the things that people are concerned about with hiring older workers is that they don't bring the energy. That's certainly very common for people to think that. And it's actually one of the myths that prevent leaders from making really good workforce decisions that actually will help them, and overlooking hidden talent, which is that older worker population. The reason for that is because in Canada, at least, and in the US, the numbers are the same. We start holding back on training, on recognition, on engagement activities, on future-focused career conversations. We start slowing down, or we stop offering those altogether to employees when they hit about age 49. Mm-hmm. So what that means is by the time someone gets into their mid-50s or late-50s and now becomes that older worker, they seem like they have less energy or they're less engaged than some of the younger staff. But nobody's shown them a lick of interest in about 10 years. And nobody's talked to them about their future. And they haven't received the same level of training. They haven't qualified for high performer programs. All the incentives that we have that keep the energy high among our younger workforce has disappeared from their experience. And so we get what we incent, right? So We're seeing that there's employees that seem like they have less energy or are less engaged because we don't engage them. If we had programs that recognize they're going to go into their legacy career, and the legacy career is a big part of what Challenge Factory does inside of organizations, recognizing that you're not just going to work longer in the same job you've been doing. If you did it for 20 years, good luck. Now you need to do it for 40 years. That sounds awful to everybody. Right. But instead, that we can actually make changes and have a new 20-year career that starts in our late 40s, early 50s, and takes us all the way through that legacy career period. If organizations had programs like that, you would find that actually the population that's in their 40s and 50s would have just as much engagement and energy, and they would be doing things that they really connect with and are really valuable and useful to the organization. So there's organizational work to be done. And that's a great example of where there's a myth, there's something we're observing, but we're causing that. It's actually not innate and part of the nature of someone just because they happen to be older.
That's such great insights, Lisa. And it's one of the reasons why I love doing this podcast. And Deb, you had said something about all the wisdom and soft skills that come with just time and time in business. And I will give credit to a fellow named Howard Kettner. He's the reason why I'm doing this podcast. I met Howard probably about 10 years ago. He was well into his 70s and he had been in my business and he'd retired for about 2 weeks and said, okay, got to do something else. So he started a group called the Benefits Genius Group. And it was employee benefit focused advisors like myself. And Howard just had so many ideas and he had built all of these platforms and things. And one was the podcast when podcasts were still fairly new. And I remember thinking the opposite. I remember thinking, how am I going to keep up with this guy? Right?
Right.
So, you know, you can't judge someone just because maybe, you know, as I pat my own head, there's some gray hairs here. Right. So I think this is such a valuable conversation. I do want to take a pivot, Lisa, because prior to a couple of weeks ago, met a wonderful guy, came on the podcast. His name is Chris Bryce, runs a company called Dot Fusion. Wonderful person. We're going to get together with him in person. Hopefully we get to do the same with you, Lisa, eventually. He had talked about on the podcast that he was a certified B Corporation. Mm. I had no idea what a B Corporation was. I'm 54 years old. I had no idea what this is. But apparently, you are a certified B Corporation. Can you just talk about that? Because what I found out was this is not an easy thing to accomplish. So maybe you can talk about from the respect of what it means and what have you learned about yourself as a business owner through that process?
Yeah. So thanks for that. I love talking about our B Corp certification. You're right. It is hard. It's a hard certification to get. There's only a couple hundred of us in Canada, a couple thousand across the world that are a part of this certification, but it's a growing movement and it's really important. So a B Corp certification means that we are audited, certified initially, and then audited every 3 years by a global body that measures the impact of our work. So we need to demonstrate that we are having an impact, positive impact, on the communities that we are a part of, that we are having a positive impact on workers, on the broader supply chain, on governance, and on the environment. And in those categories, the audit is actually, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation, even for a small business like Challenge Factory. It takes about 18 months, our experience, for the initial certification to take place. And it changes everything. We have to change our legal letters of incorporation so that we're no longer just held to make the best fiduciary decisions for our shareholders. We are responsible to other decision-making criteria as well. And it really expands the spectrum of what we consider when we are doing business, from the suppliers that we use to the standards that organizations that we work with have. It's a really, really important frame that brings into private sector organizations a global perspective of, are we actually doing good? And that's the B Corp. The B Corp slogan is business as a force for good. And it aligns us in the way that we make those decisions. We make different decisions, for sure.
I love that. Business is a force for good. And I'm hoping that by us talking about it, this is the second time now on a podcast, hopefully we're inspiring other people. And hopefully down the road, this becomes, like you said, how many in Canada right now?
There's a couple hundred.
So maybe that's a couple thousand. Yeah. And we are making an impact. I love that.
Yeah.
Lisa, what prompted you to become a B Corp? Because it is onerous.
It is onerous and rigorous, for sure. So one of the things was, I was introduced to it by another friend who owns a business who several years ago became a B Corp. And in her announcement and explaining her reasons, it just resonated so strongly with me. And Challenge Factory itself was already doing so many of the things of thinking about community, of thinking about what's good for workers. There were so many different aspects of what is already a part of our DNA that just seemed like a natural thing for us to look into and to do. The added stamp, though, of actually holding ourselves accountable in those areas was interesting for two reasons. First of all, it's really easy to let some of those decisions slip when there's all kinds of competing interests. This makes sure that we're very thoughtful about the decisions that we make. The second is, as a research-based organization, Challenge Factory is a future of work firm, but we have a research side of the house and we have a consulting side of the house. As a research-based firm, we're always interested in evaluation and metrics. And the B Corp certification holds us accountable to a set of metrics that, again, gives us a whole different perspective and set of tools for when we're doing research or when we're working with clients and people, again, that common theme of throwing their hands up and saying, well, nobody knows how you would actually measure or how you would actually know if you're making an impact. We can say, well, actually, that's not true. We can measure impact of things that are really complicated and really hard and really big, even if you're just really small, to see how we can do that. So it was a good learning process for our whole team to go through that says, if we can hold ourselves accountable to it, why can't we hold our research, our clients, the output, and the work that we're doing to those same standards?
Fantastic. You mentioned that it's private companies. How does it resonate with public companies when you are doing work for them?
So, I mean, certainly the B Corp status is a huge advantage for the people that know and understand the rigor of the certification, the validation that while we are a private sector consulting firm, but we are held to those other set of standards. that set of standards and our own assessment of it, it's on a public website that we can't control. So you can go and look up Challenge Factory B Corp assessment report. If you Google that, you're going to find our report. You're going to see how we score. And so the transparency, the accountability is incredibly powerful in our work with not just public sector clients, but public sector clients do really appreciate the rigor and the transparency that goes into that certification for sure.
My business partner, Al, who's usually on the podcast with us, who's taking a break today, he would be very jealous that we're talking about this because he is very interested in this world. And I'm sure when we do a follow-up with you, Lisa, he's going to want to be on that call. So we'll make sure that happens.
Happy to.
I want to go back to earlier when you were chatting about maybe you entered into entrepreneurship earlier than you thought you would. So can you talk about, were there any advantages or even disadvantages of being a young entrepreneur, someone looking at you thinking, oh, look at this young person. What do they know? Right?
Right.
Can you maybe talk about, and there might be the other side of the coin there too, right? So you can talk about both.
Yeah. So I'll start on the advantages. I mean, I had the privilege and the ability early in my career to work for large global firms that had very good training programs. So my management discipline, understanding of how business works, all different ways of managing risk, the legal aspects of business, through the companies that I worked for early on, I was able to come into entrepreneurship with a really, really solid business experience. And I think that that served me really well. On the flip side, not only did I become an entrepreneur younger than perhaps other people might have imagined, because I wasn't in the tech sector, like the Challenge Factory is not a tech company. And so entrepreneurship tends to come later in life if you're not in technology. The piece that was so challenging was the subject matter that I launched Challenge Factory focused on, our initial services, was about demographic change and especially career and workforce change related to older workers. So I was in my early 30s and I was talking and sharing research and doing consulting and launching services that were all focused for people that were typically older than 55. And I would get a ton of backlash early on. You could see it in comments on social media. If I was speaking at conferences, it was always a question that was at the microphone when they opened it up to say, like, that's great, but like, how could you possibly know what it's like to be a worker who's 50 or 55. You know, you don't look the part. I would get that all the time as an example of ageism in a different direction, right? And yet we have male obstetricians that deliver babies. Like, we are able to do jobs that we aren't personally having lived experience with if we have the right training and skills and ability to do that. And so I confronted that early on. You're asking this question of me right at the exact moment because I'm weeks away from turning 50, which means I am now aging into the area that I have been studying and focused on for 20 years. And so I will now legitimately be able to talk about being a 50-year-old from lived experience as well as from research and all of the different client experiences that I have had. But that was really the trickiest part, not only launching a business as a young person, but launching a business as a young person focused on older people.
And especially not being in technology, because I think we've all come to accept that, oh, the person, yeah, but it's technology, right? So being outside of that, I can totally see, you know, an audience member when you're up there doing and giving a presentation, like, oh, how does she know, right? Yeah, no, I can totally see that.
Well, is there anything you wish that you had known when you started out that you now know?
I wish that I had known just how satisfying entrepreneurship and business ownership is. I wish I had also known how hard it is. It is hard and continues to be hard in really wonderful ways because, you know, I own a company called Challenge Factory, so I'm not afraid of challenges. I actually quite thrive in it. So that's a kind of double-edged sword. But I really do wish that I had known just how gratifying it is and how satisfying it is to be an entrepreneur. I think in Canada, a lot of times, especially outside of the tech sector, but I think a lot of times in Canada, we have this mentality that, you know, entrepreneurship is kind of the thing that you do if something goes wrong in your traditional career, that you're supposed to work for a big brand or you're supposed to work for a big corporation. And I certainly know when I made the shift from large corporate to starting up my own company, people were worried about me because that's not the way you're supposed to do things. You're supposed to continue to grow in those big companies instead of starting your own. And yet, our country needs more entrepreneurs. You know, we talk about the productivity challenges that we're facing and the economic challenges that we're facing, and so many of them are solved by having more businesses that need larger workforces. And so this mindset and idea that entrepreneurship is actually a phenomenal career and wildly rewarding while still being hard and scary and challenging and keeping you growing all the way through your entire career is something that I wish I had more insight to. And I'm thrilled that I was able to find it through experience.
How do you think we could develop that and have more entrepreneurs? Like, as you said, what the incentives, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cultural a little bit. I think we underplay how many people are actually entrepreneurial. One of the dots that I can connect looking back is in every organization I was ever in, I was always on the leading edge of some new trend and having to figure it out, creating new services, creating new practices, whether it was the earliest days of e-business practices in consulting or whether it was looking at different things that were coming. I was always using entrepreneurial skills, but the idea of being an entrepreneur was just never a path that I was really all that aware of. And so I think just harnessing how many people are actually being entrepreneurial and do we celebrate that for its entrepreneurial spirit will help to elevate the idea that not everyone works inside of the public sector. Not everyone works inside of a large corporation. Most of our workforce works in small business, and we need to celebrate our entrepreneurs where we see them.
And just Lisa, I'm curious to ask you, because I just discovered this term and then I realized I had these people within our own company, intrapreneurs.
Correct. Yeah.
And there are people that have no interest in really owning the company and everything that that involves, but can be really strong players in terms of, hey, I want to build something and I want to be part of a team. And that was eye-opening for me because I realized I've got some of these great people internally which can help grow the company. So entrepreneur, great for the people that it fits for, but entrepreneurs, great as well. And certainly I'm glad to have those people. I thought I'd take a bit of a pivot toward the end of this episode and just have some fun. So Monday through Friday, just pick a day of the week.
Wednesday.
What does a perfect Wednesday look like for Lisa Taylor?
Perfect Wednesday. All right. I wake up not too early. I'm not an early person. I wake up. I have a cup of coffee. I read the newspaper, like the actual like paper copy of a newspaper. And then I get into the office. I plan my day. And it's a combination of meeting with clients, writing, doing research, spending some time outside. So it's a wide variety of activities over the course of the day, but it definitely includes some client interaction, some writing and research time. I knock off at the end of the day, probably meet up with some friends on a patio for a drink or for an end of day, just meet up.
I like that idea.
Yeah, have a chance to be able to relax a little bit. And then I check in with family. My kids don't live at home with us anymore. So we check in at usually in the evening, spend time with my husband later on that night, watch something that's really completely frivolous and probably embarrassing on TV with no solid value for anything.
Listen, I watched Jersey Shore last night. So you're definitely not going to embarrass yourself.
There you go. And that's it. That's my day.
Very cool. Well, I'm glad I asked because I'm always curious and I'm glad that we share that in common watching these frivolous shows because you know what? Life is so serious. So let's escape once in a while.
Agreed.
Deb, I'm going to give you last word before we wrap it up because once again, you have proven my theory of really great people know other really great people. So I do appreciate this introduction.
Thanks, Robin. The $1 million question, are we going back to the office or are we working from home?
Great question.
Yeah. So I don't think we're destined to work from home forever. I think that, you know, the number of conversations that we have with people who, even if they are in a work from home scenario, and let's just say also, like not everyone is in a business or in a situation where work from home ever was possible or even is possible now, right? So the number of people that we're talking about is a small subset of our actual workforce. They're missing a bunch of things like social interaction and engagement. They're starting to talk about how their workplace, it's not all that it was cracked up to be a year ago when they were still gung-ho. So we're really starting to see some of that shift. We published a blog earlier in the pandemic where we also listed for organizations why it's really important that they help to facilitate their workforce back into workplaces. And I know that that's a really controversial topic at the moment and always has been, but Challenge Factory really believes that employers are a central organizing structure in our society. They actually are places that help with social cohesion. They are places where we check in with each other on a regular basis to see how people are doing. There is a lot of that that gets broken if we're not going to be spending time together. And it doesn't mean we have to spend time like we used to. Doesn't mean that everyone has to commute to an office that takes 2 hours. There's lots of ways for us to figure out and reconfigure what it means to go to the office, but we can't live in our basements forever. That's not going to happen. And so that's my hot take on what's going on with the return to work. And under the context of future of work, we get asked that all the time. And what I would want to just convey is that's not the future of work. It's actually the now of work, and figuring that out for now for your culture is really important and gives you good clues on whether you're in a position to be able to plan and strategize the future of work. Because if the now of work is tripping you up, let's solve that and then sort out what you want to do about the future.
That's brilliant. The now of work. I'm taking that with me.
And that really echoes my conversations that I'm having with my clients as well. I have a range of people sold their office during COVID and said, we're going 100% remote. Most have gone to some hybrid approach, 2 to 3 days a week. I was in a lady's office yesterday and she very resentfully said they're back 5 days a week. But for our own company, we have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then we bookend the start and the end of the week, you know, at home, which we find is working really well.
Yep.
What I do really like is I function really well in a remote environment. I often say I'm more focused, which is true, but I do miss those interactions at work. And with the younger people, especially, I see people, you know, having a coffee together or running over to someone's desk and having those natural collisions that don't happen outside of when you're working from home. So I tend to agree with that. I don't see our company ever going back to 5 days a week, but I think 3 is a good balance and everybody seems to be doing well with that. But we'll see. We'll see what the future holds. Lisa, as you talk about the future of work, we're handling the now. I want to thank you so much. And Deb, thank you again for the introduction. Again, great people know other great people. Lisa, thanks for joining us today and sharing your journey. What's the best way for people to reach out to you if they have questions about yourself or what you're doing at the Challenge Factory?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn, Lisa Taylor. It helps if you search with Challenge Factory. It's a common name. The other way as well is Challenge Factory's at challengefactory.ca. You can go check out that URL that we were able to secure all those years ago in 2012 when I started the company. And yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
Wonderful. Well, that does it for today's episode. We really enjoyed this conversation. As always, we hope you did too. If you have any questions for not Al and myself this time, Deb and myself, please feel free to give us a call or by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. And as you've seen here, success leaves clues. We'll see you next time.